We're doing Parashat Nitzavim, Parasha Summary, Wednesday night. Yeah. And the request was made to do a little bit of methodology with the Parasha Summary. And what we'll do is give a sampling of the methodology. And then after doing that for a week or two, starting off with the sampling of the methodology, we'll take a vote and see how many guys want to have a full class on methodology. Methodology, basically what we mean by that is going through a section of the parasha word by word and analyzing what that word means and what that word could potentially mean. And the first step in gaining true understanding is recognizing the questions. So once upon a time we used to have a 45-minute class with just asking questions, going through the parasha and posing potential answers. The problem is that the attendance rate to that class was at about somewhere between one student and three students. Even though whenever we asked if guys wanted the class, everyone said, yes, it's very important, let's do the class. So that's why we're going to do a little bit of a compromise to begin with, and then we'll take a vote. We'll see how many people say they want a full class on this. But for now, let's run through the parsha, and towards the end of class, we'll take a few minutes to sample a little bit of methodology. The methods of how to learn the parsha, how you learn Tanakh, how do you break down the words, what questions should you ask as you read through it, how do you decipher what is the root of the word, how do you decipher where are the pauses in the pasuk. This is elementary. It's very important. Everyone agrees ideologically that it's important, but it's pretty boring.
Be your own Rashi.
It's like be your own Rashi. It's discover what was bothering Rashi. Correct. So let's begin the parsha. Our parsha is called Nitzavim. Nitzavim, we have two parshas this week, Nitzavim and Vayelech. We have the last mitzvahs in the Torah in our parshas. The Torah ends with the mitzvah to write down the Torah. There's a mitzvah that every Jew should write his own Sefer Torah. We have the mitzvah of Hakel, the mitzvah of gathering the Jewish people for the king to speak to them and tell them parts of the Torah. That happens once every 7 years. Coming up, they did it on Shemitah. So on Shemitah, nowadays they do a mock hakel, a fake hakel, a light hakel. They get all the big rabbis together and you get a tremendous number of Jews coming to the Kotel and Sukkos for this mock hakel. But it's not really the full-fledged mitzvah. The mitzvah is that a king does it, and there are preconditions which I don't think we'll get to tonight. Our parsha is really continuing off of what was said in last week. Moshe Rabbeinu told the Jewish people if they don't keep the Torah, then whole bunch of curses will come and there'll be exile. And the Jews were scared. They were scared. There's a halacha that if a parent wants to reprimand his son, so he should reprimand him. If he wants to punish him, he should punish him, but he shouldn't threaten him. A kid once was making trouble in school and he came home and his father pointed to the ear. In ancient times, he used to punish a kid by pulling him by the ear. And his father pointed to the ear. He said, I heard from the Rebbe how you were behaving today. And the kid got so scared he went and committed suicide. And a few stories like this are brought in the Talmud. And from there we derive a halacha that if a person wants to punish a son, he has to be quick and get it over with. But when there's a threat of a punishment, then the anticipation, the fear of what might come is worse than the actual punishment itself. And we see that kids committed suicide out of fear. So in last week's parasha, we had just that. We had a threat. The Torah speaks about how bad the punishments will be, how people will wake in the morning and say, if only it was last night. They'll hit the night and they'll say, if it only was the morning. The morning wasn't as bad as tonight is, and in the morning they'll think last night wasn't as bad as this morning is. The Torah describes how terrible the curses that God has in store for those who don't keep the Torah, and the Jews were scared. So Moshe has to give them a pep talk. Says, Atem nitzavim ayom kulchem, hey, you made it. We're about to enter the land of Israel, and you made it. Look, in spite of everything you sinned, how many times did you sin throughout the desert, and still you made it. And that's something which I think is very poignant today. We're coming towards Rosh Hashanah. Every person is thinking, what did I do wrong this year? Got to do better. We also have to remember, I made it. I'll make it further. I have to do better. I'll do better. But I made it thus far. And that's always encouragement. Moshe tells him, look, you've all made it. And God wants to make a treaty with you. And this isn't the first treaty God has made with the Jewish people. We know there was the Bris Bein Absarim. God made a pact with Avram. That wasn't with the Jewish people. We know that when the Jews came to Har Sinai, there was also a bris. There was a treaty between God and the Jewish people. What was their treaty about? The Torah, he says, huh?
Ten commandments and like the sacrifices and the stuff.
So let's take a step back. When was this treaty done?
Before they got the Torah, we'll do it.
So the Jews heard the Ten Commandments, and Moshe Rabbeinu brought a special sacrifice. He took the blood from that sacrifice and sprinkled it, threw it at the Jewish people, and a miracle happened. Every Jew got a drop of blood on his garment. The Torah says that the Jews pressured this garment that had a drop of blood on it. They said, this is the drop of blood that signifies our pact with God. When was the last time you guys thought about the bris you have? You have a bris. Yeah. I think everyone here has a bris. I don't know. Those of you who haven't yet finished Giyur, so maybe you don't yet have a bris. When was the last time you thanked God for the fact that you have a bris? So the truth is, in benching, we thank God every day. We say, no delecha, we thank you Hashem for this great land, the al biris chashechasamta vivsereinu, and on the bris that you sealed in our bodies. When we give our child the bris milah, God made a pact with Avraham Avinu, a bris over the milah, over the taking off of the foreskin. That's the bris milah. A bris is a covenant, it's a pact. We have a pact with God, and that pact is engraved in our bodies. We have a bris. And God made a pact with the Jewish people at Sinai that we're going to fulfill the Torah and we're going to be His chosen people. But that was that generation. And now before we enter the land of Israel, so there's a pact which is binding upon all generations. God says, gather all the Jewish people together. There's going to be a pact between all the Jews and generations to come and me. So we say that all of our neshamas were there at Sinai. You guys should all know that from that website. Met you at Sinai, what's it called? That dating site? Saw you at Sinai, right? That's based on that medrash that says that we were all there. Saw you at Sinai. Yeah, we were all there. Our neshamas were there. That doesn't bind us. What binds us to the performance of the Torah is our parsha, where God made a pact and He said, this pact is for generations to come.
Weren't they circumcised just before they entered the land?
No. They entered the land uncircumcised. They circumcised when they entered the land. Just when they entered, they got circumcised.
Why did they get circumcised too late?
Because in the desert they felt it would be a danger to the children to be circumcised under the conditions they were living. The Gemara says there are special conditions that help a person heal from circumcision, and even though people could have circumcised and they would have stayed alive, but they were concerned and they had a halachic loophole to not circumcise, so they didn't. And when they entered the land of Israel, then they did mass circumcision. And they did a mountain of foreskins, yeah.
Morning,
yeah, just saying. Yeah, Ari?
So, there were people that converted to Judaism while they were in the desert?
That's a good question. The Torah says we're talking to the Gerim. Who were those Gerim? So in a second we'll discuss that.
Because we learned 2 years ago, there are cook, right, that unless you have circumcision, you're not considered...
Again?
Yeah.
So that's not Rav Kook. That's Halacha. We derive from the Jews at Sinai that they underwent the process of getting a circumcision, of immersion, of accepting the mitzvot. So to any ger that wants to become a ger must be circumcised and then immerse himself in the mikvah water. Circumcision alone is nothing. And then accept all the mitzvot of the Torah. And then he is a ger. It has to be under the auspices of a beis din.
It's like a condition for conversion, right? Whether it's not a requirement or not. And then, like, there's somebody who had, hemophilia, and so couldn't feel conversion. So he said it. You know this friend?
Oh, yeah, no.
I'm thinking.
Rabbi Goldenberg in the Kuzari, what he says, he said, is a brit milah, is it just a normal, does a convert get it because it's one of the many mitzvot, you get it just like a Jew does, you know, it's one of the mitzvot, you do it the same way you keep kosher, or is it something special for converts, so that if you cannot get it for health reasons, you cannot convert? He said, if a potential convert has like hemophilia and he can't get circumcision, he can't be Jewish. It doesn't matter if it's a health thing.
Okay, yeah. What?
They weren't circumcised even for...
No, they were circumcised.
They were circumcised, but the Jews were not circumcised.
The Jews were circumcised at Sinai because there was mass circumcision before the Paschal offering, the Korban Pesach, in Egypt, in Mitzrayim. So the Jews who came to Sinai were all circumcised. Afterwards, when we spent 40 years in the desert, that generation did not circumcise their children. So the children who entered the land of Israel, anyone who was 40 years and under, or 39 years and under, those children needed a circumcision when they entered the land of Israel.
And so there were no converts between Sinai and Israel?
There were converts. The Torah says they were circumcised. The tribe of Levi also circumcised their kids in the desert. The circumcision... The Torah says that the Moshe Rabbeinu says, I'm speaking to all of the Jews, including the converts. Who were the converts? So our sages say there were a group of Gentiles from the land of Israel who knew that we were coming in and we were going to conquer the land, and they were scared that they'd get killed. So they came and they said, we came from a faraway land, we heard about your great Torah, we want to join the Jews. And they tricked the Jews into accepting them, and then after they became gerim, they became converts, then we discovered they were part of the seven nations that we had a mitzvah to attack and enter, conquer in the land of Israel. So Moshe assigned them to be water carriers and woodcutters. And then in the time of David HaMelech, there was a period when Shaul, King Saul, we are going to learn, he killed out the city of Nov, the city of Kohanim. And when he killed out the city of Nov, so these people, they were called the Givonim, their job had been to support water, to supply water and wood for the city of Nov. When the city of Nov was killed out, so they lost some of their men because they no longer had Parnassa, and they died either of famine or maybe they were also collectively killed in the city of Nov. It doesn't seem to say that. It seems like they lost their source of sustenance. And they came with a claim that we want the blood of King Saul's family because they caused the death of people from our family. And David HaMelech, King David, begged them. He said, I'll pay you money, I'll give you what you want, but don't ask for people to be killed. There was a mistake done, but don't ask for a life instead of a life. And they said, no, we insist on it. And there was a famine in the land of Israel, and God said the famine isn't going to leave till the Givonim are appeased. So David felt he didn't have a choice, and because they were wronged, even though they weren't Jews, they were gerim. At that point, we did treat them as Jews, but they were wronged. Shaul HaMelech wronged them, so they had a right to their claim. But David begged them to have extra compassion and mercy and not have this bloodshed, and they wouldn't forgive. And so David had lots drawn, and ultimately people from King Saul's family were given over to the Givonim. And at that point, David HaMelech decreed, as the Navi says, "V'Givonim lo mibnei Yisrael heima." The Givonim are no longer Jews. And here we find the power that rabbis have to decide that a certain people are not Jews. And that's what King David did. And he decreed that the Givonim aren't Jews. And at that point, King David told us this basic understanding into what a Jew is. He said that every Jew, everyone that comes from Abraham, Avraham Avinu, has to have three traits. And if he doesn't have those traits, then must be he's not a Jew. And that is, he is Rachmanim, he has extra compassion, mercy, he goes beyond the call of duty, and these people didn't have that, that's why he decided that they're not Jews. They are Baishanim, just a second, they are people who get embarrassed, that's a good trait. As Jews, we view that as a good trait, that a person gets embarrassed. And there are Gomnei Chasadim, and they do kindness to other people, beyond the call of duty. When these people showed they don't have that, so King David decreed, they are no longer to be considered Jews. And they are what's known as the Givonim. Yeah?
These are character traits that differ from person to person.
But there's a base element that has to be there. Statistically, Jews, Orthodox, non-Orthodox, from and non-from, make up a percentage of charity givers that outnumbers their percentage of the population, I think more than 10 to 1. The percentage of charity that's given by Jews correlated to their percentage of the population, I think, is more than 10 to 1. I think we make up of something like 60 or 70% of the charity donations in the world, and I don't think we make 6 to 7% of the population. Not even close. No, there was a statistic that someone once did on that. What?
The whole world were 0.25%.
Okay, so you guys do the math. So Moshe Rabbeinu gathers the Jewish people together with the woodcutters and the water drawers, which we just explained. They were the Givonim, who at this point are still considered like Jews, and they are what Ari asked, did we have converts at this point? We had converts. These were converts. And they are all part of the pact that God makes with the Jewish people. God says, I'm making this pact with the Jewish people.
Is it Jethro's family?
No, not Jethro's family. Different converts. God says, I'm making this pact with the Jewish people today to establish them as God's nation, and He is their God. What does this mean? The Jewish people are the chosen nation, and there is a pact that they are going to remain the chosen nation. And God says, if you sin, so you'll be exiled and you'll be punished, but you'll still be the chosen people. And this is the simple refutation of the Christian claim that you're exiled, you're suffering, so how could you be the chosen people? So the Torah says, you are the chosen people, and if you sin, you will be exiled, and there will be a punishment. The Torah says that very clearly. And the Torah says, and you're still the chosen people. And that is the pact that is in the beginning of our parsha. Yeah?
We see when the Jews first sinned with the Chetah Evil, and even after that, I think there were a few cases, or a few, there definitely was one, when Hashem threatened to have the Jewish people wiped out and replaced by new people. And he offered that to Moshe Rabbeinu.
So what did he offer? He said, the Jews are still the chosen people. I have to wipe out the Jewish men who sinned by the Egel, but the women weren't going to be wiped out. And you, Moshe Rabbeinu, and the Levim, who did not sin in the Egel, even though the Torah only says, I'll make you into a great nation, but why would the Levim be killed if they didn't sin? And why would the women be killed if they didn't sin? But let's say that we read it simply put, and God says, I'll make you into the nation. So two answers. A, that was before the pact in our parsha, and B, God still says the chosen people will be the Jews, only the Jews will have like a new patriarch. Moshe Rabbeinu will be the forefather of the Jewish people. That's how our sages say, that's what God was telling Moshe Rabbeinu. So even if you would understand the Pesukim literally, it's still the Jewish people. It's still a continuation, but there's a new patriarch, a new beginning from Moshe. Yeah?
Nowadays, does anyone ever say so-and-so is not Jewish because he doesn't have his college?
Good question. Let's leave that as a question. That's a class in and of itself. Can the rabbis apply that nowadays? That's a class that has to go into the whole concept of what is a mishumat, a Jew that decides he's leaving the faith, or a Jew that wants to destroy other Jews. How do we treat him? What his halachic status is as far as Jew? Why is it that we say that when a Jew like that touches wine, we shouldn't drink it? Why is it that we don't trust him and we say that his shechita is non-kosher? So there's a whole section in Shulchan Aruch that deals with this, but that's for a class in and of itself, which we will not have here. Telling you already. Now, don't expect it. Our job here is to deal with bringing people close, not talking about pushing people away. You're asking a question, how do you push someone away if he's a sinner? It's a good question. When you learn Gemara, eventually you'll get it. You'll learn it. Okay. Our parsha is focusing on the treaty with God and the Jewish people, and our parsha is on the day of Moshe's death. From this parsha on, we're dealing with the day of Moshe's death, which we don't know when it is. We have a tradition, it is Zayin Adar, but this tradition is not recorded in the Torah. It's a tradition that we mathematically derive, working backwards from the day we came out of the Jordan, we crossed over the Jordan, we say, okay, how many days was that since Moshe's death, and then we do the math. But it is unclear whether that year was a leap year, for example. We don't know if Moshe died in Adar Aleph or Adar Beis. Was there an Adar Aleph, Adar Beis that year? We don't know. And it is unclear how to do the math, but we do have a tradition that Moshe Rabbeinu passed away Zayin Adar, the seventh day of the month of Adar. Yeah?
We know how many years ago
that
was,
don't we? We do. Why can't you figure out? Right. The rules that we have of deciding when's going to be a leap year is a something that's derived later on. Oh, initially, he was 120 years old, Moshe Rabbeinu.
And don't we have a tradition? So we don't know when he was born, because
we know he was born 120 years earlier. And even that's not so clear whether he was 120 or 121. Whenever we discuss an age, so the question is, do we mean that full age, meaning 120 years plus the final year, he filled out the final year, meaning he reached age 121, or he was really 120? And the source for this problem is the fact that it says that Moshe Rabbeinu was 80 years old when he first appeared to the Jewish people. And Moshe Rabbeinu led the Jews through the period of the plagues, which we have tradition took a year, the Mishnah in Eduyo says. So that puts Moshe Rabbeinu at 81 when they left Egypt. add 40 years to 81, then you get 121. So you could say that when the Torah says he was 80 years old, the Torah rounded from 79 to 80. At the same token, you could say that when the Torah says 120, the Torah is rounding from 121 to 120. Or you could say that 120 means the full 120, up to the beginning of the 121st.
And was Moshe in the desert for the full 40 years?
Yeah.
But the day he died, they came into the land of Israel?
No, spent 30 days mourning after Moshe Rabbeinu died. He died, we spent 30 days mourning, and then at some point we entered the land of Israel. Is it one day after the days of mourning, 2 days, 3 days? That's a discussion. How the days, how we factor those days.
Haman was drawing the lots.
Yeah.
So he said that it was because it was Moshe's death, but also his birthday. So if Purim is an Ardar, we celebrate Purim and Ardar Bet, can't we make that connection? But therefore, the reason we celebrate Ardar Bet is because Moshe died during Ardar Bet, was born in Ardar Bet.
So good idea. The only question is, was it a leap year, the year that Haman made his lots? That only works if that year was also a leap year.
But we celebrate in the leap year.
That's a technicality. It's like a bar mitzvah. Also, we celebrate in Adar Beis. If one child is born in a year that's a leap year, he's born on Yud Gimel. Let's say he's born on Dalet Adar, Adar Beis, and another child is born. I'm sorry, he's born on Dalet. Let's say he's born on Dalet Adar Beis, and another child is born on Chaf Dalet Adar Aleph. And then the year of the bar mitzvah is not a leap year, so then the one who was born later is going to have bar mitzvah earlier, because that's a technicality, how we apply the laws of Adar Aleph and Adar Beis. Yeah, Davin?
So I'm curious, okay, so Moshe Rabbeinu dies, we mourn for 30 days, and then we enter the land of Israel. Is the land of Israel symbolized by when we cross the Jordan?
In certain aspects, the eastern side of the Jordan is considered the land of Israel, and in certain aspects, not. Essentially, we say that the land of Israel is the western side of the Jordan. But there are aspects where the eastern side of the Jordan is also considered the land of Israel.
There were the three tribes that had land.
Correct, yeah. The question is, what holiness did that land have? How much was that land obligated to the mitzvahs of the land? Did they take off Trumas, Maestras, Shemitah, etc.? Yeah, Max.
How did they get from Egypt to the east side of the Jordan River without passing through the Negev?
So that, God willing, if you'll be here, and if not, I'll email me. When we deal with Parshas V'Shalach, we'll deal with different maps trying to figure out how they traveled. That's for a class in and of itself. Okay, no, it's a good question. We'll deal with that.
This is what we expect to go really wide.
They went through the Sinai and into what is today Jordan.
Okay, we'll see. We'll look at different maps. So the Jews are there to have a treaty. What's a treaty? A treaty is a brit. What's a brit? What's a brit?
Treaty.
Oh, a treaty, okay. So the ancient custom used to be that when two people would make a deal and they wanted to show that they are going to keep their ends of the deal, they'd slaughter an animal, put two parts of the meat on two sides, walk in between. Right, very good. And that was a sign that if I don't keep my end of the deal, that's what should happen to me. So what does it mean when we do such a pact with God? Something to ponder. God says he's making a pact with the Jewish people, and he's going to keep his promise to the forefathers, and he's going to keep what he told us. And this pact is with future generations. The pact is with that generation and the generations to come. And here we have to ask ourselves, how can one obligate future generations? If I wasn't there, how am I obligated? How does that work? We're going to... This is something... Separate class we have to have. How much can a father obligate his son? If I decide my offspring shouldn't eat meat, can I do such a thing? Institute something for my offspring. We find in Tanakh that people did that. They instituted... Yonadav ben Rechav said his offspring shouldn't drink wine. And they kept his institution. How does that work? How does the concept of minhag work? Etc. God says, look, you know what happened in Egypt? And maybe there's someone here whose mind goes back to Egypt, which isn't such a far-fetched thought, because we see that what happened when the Jews started sinning? They left Egypt, they got the Ten Commandments, and then when things went bad, they thought Moshe died, they said, oh, let's set an idol. What's their first choice of an idol? They take a calf, they make a golden calf. Well, golden calf, the calves are what the Egyptians were worshipping. So we see that the first time the Jews sin, they revert to their old ways. So God is saying, maybe after 40 years in the desert, there's someone here, Moshe Rabbeinu is saying, maybe there's someone here who's thinking, I really would like to go back to the Egyptian ways. I'd like to go to the ways of the nations we see around us. Yeah?
I thought they chose the calf though because it symbolized Hashem's throne. That was like some other reasons for that.
There are higher reasons. We're talking on a simplistic level. When we get to that parsha, we'll discuss deeper reasons why they chose a calf. That's true. The angels that they saw had feet of calves. The angels that they saw, the feet of those angels were calf feet.
Feet.
Correct. Mm-hmm. That the prophet in...
Don't they have...
The calf's foot is very straight.
Sorry, not the calf. The angel.
The angel, it says, their feet are straight, right? Very good. Like lem yisharak echaf ege. Over there, it says their feet are straight, like the foot of a calf. And from there, we derive that when we stand Shmona Esrei, we put our feet together as though they were one foot, like the angels whose feet are together, like one foot, like the foot of a calf. It says raglehem, their feet, not foot. Yeshara are straight together, kechaf ege, like the foot of a calf. Over there, that's where it says. So it seems like they have 2 feet. But they come together very close and looks like one foot of a calf.
Does a calf walk like
that? I don't know. Yeah. What do angels need feet for? They fly. What do they need wings for? Okay, so that's in a class on angels.
Yeah. Calves walk around with their feet like this?
Oh, so that's a good question. What does it mean straight? Yeah. Ari. Oh, we're getting very sidetracked. Yeah.
Reliable source.
What?
I heard from a less than reliable source that feet is a euphemism. And the reason the wings were covering on the feet is for modesty.
So, we'll discuss that if we ever get to that prophet.
Is there any chance that that's like a
Well, it says that they're covering their feet. They're using their wings to cover their feet. So the question is, why are they covering their feet? So one understanding is it's out of modesty. Another understanding is that they don't want to remind God, so to speak, of the Jews' sin in the Egel, and their feet are calf's feet. So that those are two possible understandings. But remember, we don't know what an angel is. We don't know what wings are. We don't know why they need wings. We don't know why they need feet. We don't know why they need feet like calves. So we don't begin to understand the whole concept. So we're talking like on a 3-year-old level, which I don't mind if you don't mind. But we just have to remind ourselves that there is more depth to this than just seeing that angels with wings. I mean, they do have 6 set of wings. What do they need wings for? Okay, so that's for a class on angels, which will not be given by me. Yeah. No. I will just tell you an interesting thought that my father says. The word angel, malach, also means messenger. And when we speak about malachim, we have to know that God sends into people's lives malachim. Those are messengers. And a person doesn't always have to expect that his salvation is going to come in the form of something with a halo and wings. But salvation sometimes comes in the form of a human being who is a messenger. And every person can and should be a messenger to be a help to other people's lives. And every person can be a malach, if you want to understand the malach that way. Let's continue with our parasha. God says, you saw all those idols among the nations, and maybe someone here, a man or a woman, is thinking, you know what? That seems to make sense to me. Zeus, I'm going to pray to Zeus. And nothing bad will happen to me because I'm among the Jewish people and God won't punish collectively everyone else for what I'm doing wrong. So God says, I will punish you. I'll take care of you. I'll take care of you on a personal level. The rest of the people don't have to suffer for what you did. But God tells Jewish people, you do have collective responsibility. And this concept is called Arivut. Arivut literally is co-signers. We're all co-signers for one another. We all have responsibility that we all keep the mitzvahs. So if I wake up in the morning and I see my roommate isn't getting up for Shachris, I take a bucket of water, pour it on his head. And he says, you're nuts. And I say, he's right. That's not what Arivut means. Arivut does not mean that if... does not mean that I look over someone else's shoulders and I say... my job is to ensure that you keep the mitzvos, like the Chazon Ish writes. It doesn't work today. Even if we had a Jewish police force keeping Torah and mitzvos and Sanhedrin, and we had all the power we wanted, we still wouldn't come to people's homes and say, turn off that TV on Shabbos. Because that's not the way that things should work today. Today you're not going to bring people closer by putting guns to their head. So free choice, that's a different question. There was a king named Chizkiyah who did that. He had a special KGB, and they used to travel around the people in the time of the first temple, Chizkiyah HaMelech, and they'd search everyone's houses for idols. And our sages say it didn't work. They said that people would put half the idol on one door and half the idol on the other door, and when the guards would when his KGB would come in, they'd open the door, and then he couldn't see the figurine of the idol because it was divided. His KGB would leave, they'd close the door, and now you have the two doors together again. You have the idol together. Not much of a KGB, even though he did to an extent. He succeeded. It says in his generation, even the littlest kid knew all the laws of purity. He succeeded to a great extent, but ultimately there were many people who mocked him and wanted to get away with serving idols, and they were successful. He was a big tzaddik, but he didn't succeed completely. So nowadays, that's not what our job is. The concept of collective avut is that if you know someone's doing wrong, then there is a responsibility to try and get him to do right. Now, to try and get him to do right is with the means that we have, to speak to him nicely, to speak to him gently. The halacha does say that you rebuke a person to the point that he beats you up. You can nag. Now, that doesn't mean that when we're sitting together at Machon Meir and we're all working to be positive people, that we can look over one another's shoulders. Because in order to rebuke someone, you have to make sure you know very, very well what the halacha is, and that you know where that person is holding, and that where that person is holding, it makes sense to rebuke him. And all those factors are almost 100% non-relevant almost 100% of the time. So before you think of rebuking someone, you should ask your rabbi, because I can tell you almost 100% of the time, it's not relevant practically. Now, what you could do practically is you see a guy who's wearing his tefillin down on his forehead, so you could tell him, could you help me with this chapter here in Kitzur Shulchan Aruch? I need help reading it. And you read it with him, and together you discover that, oh, it says there you should put your tefillin up here. So that means like up here, right? Yeah, you figure it out together. You could do things gently and nicely and pleasantly. And then he discovers that the tefillin have to be above the hairline. And even that, I'd be careful before I do it. You have to remember, especially here in Machon Meir, everyone's working to move forward. And no one can judge where someone else is and where someone else is coming from. And people grow when you give them the space and the love to grow. And our job is to give them space and love, not pressure. So peer pressure, I don't believe in, not religiously. And this is a word to all the new guys that are here. And all the old guys that are here are looking over the new guys' shoulders. If they want your advice, they'll ask for it, and until then, leave them be. And I'm saying that our parsha says we are responsible for one another, but that responsibility should be expressed in a positive way. That if I made Kiddush on Shabbos morning and someone else wants to hear Kiddush, even though I fulfilled my obligation, because I have collective responsibility, we have arevut, so I haven't finished fulfilling my responsibility till every Jew has finished fulfilling his responsibility. So I tell him, I can make Kiddush for you. I could blow shofar for you, even though I blew shofar. You could blow shofar for me. All those people go to the old age home and read Megillah with a blessing. They already read Megillah with a blessing. How could they do it again? They fulfilled their obligation. Because we say no Jew finishes fulfilling his obligation until every Jew has finished fulfilling his obligation. So that collective responsibility allows us to help one another in the performance of mitzvah. I could say a blessing for you. How can I do that? So one aspect is Shomei Keoneh. We say that when you hear me saying something and you have the intent to say it, so there's halacha that it's considered like you said it. But there's also the aspect of arevut, that our collective responsibility makes it that we can do mitzvot for one another, and we aren't finished fulfilling a mitzvot till we all finish. Yeah?
Let's just say like you like daven one of the times, and then someone says like, I need a minion, you know, can you only flip far and wide, can only find that keyboard, like, can you like daven the whole thing again?
You can't daven the whole thing again, but you could stand there, and when you have 10 people, then you have the holiness of a minion. You can't daven it again. But let's say you benched, and someone else doesn't know how to bench. Say Birkat HaMazon. So then you could say Birkat HaMazon for him, because he doesn't know how. The ideal way is to say it without God's name, and he should repeat after you. He should say it. But if he can't do even that, so you say it for him. Just saying, Jeff wants him. Yeah?
You just answered. I was going to ask you about a sermon.
Okay.
If you've already been in one, be in another one.
Okay, so that we have to have a whole class on Zeman. No, you can't do it twice. No.
What if you're still eating?
If you're still eating, if I'm not mistaken, you still cannot do Zeman twice.
If
you're still eating, so you could answer and then continue eating.
And then it's not considered being for the Zeman, or
you are part of the Zimun. Let's say three people are eating, two finished and one didn't. So he could stop his meal, enter the Zimun. If he's a Sephardi, then he could continue right away. If he's an Ashkenazi, then he should wait till the end of the first blessing and then continue eating. And I hope I didn't get that backwards. Yeah, I might have gotten that. I got it backwards?
Right.
Switched it? Okay. Yeah.
I agree with what you're saying before with the whole, you shouldn't rebuke your friend, especially if you're Machamer or all brother and everything. But like, if it's something like davening, something that doesn't have a lot of bearing, like davening, and you're both Ashkenazi or both Sephardi or whatever, if someone's asking a lot of questions, then it might be okay to jump the gun, you know, because they might be like feel like they're asking too many questions. And
I don't know. My philosophy in life is answer what people ask you, and when you answer more, you always risk overstepping the boundaries. Every time in my life that I went, I gave more information than I was asked, and I'm talking about where I, who have this philosophy, felt that I could allow myself to do it, I think the majority of the times I regretted it afterwards. I think so. I don't remember all times offhand, but generally, my feeling is, someone wants something, he'll ask you. And if he doesn't ask, lo abayshan lamed. Sages taught us, if a person is bashful, then he won't learn. Part of learning is you have to have the guts to get up and ask. Sometimes you could say, look, if you want, we could have a chavrusa, we could learn this. You could offer a guy something that's less intrusive. But people like to grow at their own pace. And we have to allow people to do that. No one can grow in one day. Halacha says when a person comes and becomes a ger, so you don't look over his shoulder. You take into account that he didn't know anything yesterday, and today he does know. So he won't keep kashrus the best way the first day, and not even the first year, not even the second year. It's impossible, and we don't expect it of him. And that's what the Rebbe from Chabad said. We derive from gerim and from a child when he becomes bar mitzvah that the Torah doesn't expect us to know the whole Torah at any given second. We're supposed to learn it and eventually know it all. But a person isn't going to be taken to task, why didn't you know the whole Torah at age 13? Because you see, a ger becomes a ger, and then you teach him the whole Torah. You teach him the basics, you teach him the general ideas, and if he says, this is what I want, and I'm going to keep the rest of it as I learn it, so he becomes a ger. And then that means the first Shabbos, he doesn't know all the laws of Shabbos. He's not keeping Shabbos. Why do we do that? Let him get a doctorate in Judaism, and then we'll accept him. So we don't do that. Why? Because this teaches us that that's not what God wants. God says you'll learn as you go along, and also a child when he becomes bar mitzvah, he doesn't know everything. He knows what he's seen at home, and then slowly he learns. But one of the things that you guys should take to heart is when you see normal things around you, what you see everyone else doing is a good idea to do. The guy who you see doing something abnormal, don't learn from. But everything else that's what you see the general populace doing, so you should do. That's how every kid learns. If a person didn't grow up in from home, so he should at least see when he's around from people. What do? Back to our parasha. So the Torah says, you were among the nations and you saw their disgusting things. And Torah is referring to their idols. And here we see the Torah teaches us that when we speak about idols, we should refer to them as disgusting things. We don't speak about that beautiful cathedral, that gorgeous church. We don't say that. We don't even use it as a landmark. We don't say, oh, you want to know where Migrash HaRusim is? You want to go to the police station here in Jerusalem? It's next to the Roman Catholic Church up next to Yaffa. You don't say that. You don't use the church even as a sign. And when we mention it, we always mention its disgrace. We don't mention its positive things. The sages were careful that they even changed the names. And when people walk by, they always cross the street. You'll notice that they don't even walk next to the entrance. Like the Pasuk says in Mishlei, don't walk near the entrance of a brothel. A person could say, well, nothing will happen. Don't trust yourself that nothing will happen. Cross the street, don't even walk down that entrance, don't even walk down that street. So the same thing is true by a church. A person can say, I won't be tempted. We say, no, don't even walk on that side of the street. Yeah?
There was a problem in Thessaloniki. There is literally every second corner of a church. And I really mean every second corner. And you can't cross each
okay.
road.
Well, you can't do. But, you could, but what you could do is get off the sidewalk. Yeah. You don't have to walk right near it. You could distance yourself a little bit.
Sometimes we would say you have a sidewalk like this, and directly there next to you is the church. So is this considered?
What you can't do, you can't do. You don't have to go crazy. What you could do, you should do.
The same with the brothel. Every second corner.
So that I could tell you, that seriously, I used to get off the bus in Manhattan, on I don't remember which street it was, but there's a street that's that way too, and that's where the bus drops you off. So I was careful to get off one stop earlier, so it meant more walking for me, and to go on a little bit to circumvent. So it's worth the circumlocution rather than walking down that street. And you know what? Any person who thinks that he's immune is either lying to himself or not normal. Because if you're normal, so God created you with certain urges and needs and wants, and we were told, don't follow your heart, don't follow your eyes. We say it in Shema every day. Because what the eye sees, the heart wants. And if you don't let your eye see, then there's less of a chance that your heart will want. 100%. That's why if you notice, I switched from a Yahoo account. Yahoo, anytime you open them, they show you immodest pictures. You try to access your mail, they're showing you pictures. Google, you don't have any pictures. Gmail. That's why I switched. Because you just open your... Just open your account. I heard that, Ari. You just open your account. It's not right. Like I told my wife, I wouldn't bring a magazine with such pictures into the house. So how can I bring such pictures just because it's on the internet into the house? What makes it more proper just because it's on the internet? So the Torah says, you saw, unfortunately, the disgusting things in Egypt. You saw the different idols that the nations around you had. And maybe you're attracted to it. So God says, now we're making a treaty, lest there be a man, a woman, a tribe, someone here who deep down inside has the roots that will flourish and give this forth. So God says, these are the curses, these are the warnings. And we discussed that one of the things that you see, the charlatans always threaten. If you don't do what I say, you'll lose such and such and such. You see that, I see that now. A lot of you guys are helping us with this cancer patient that the doctors have said they can't help her with anything. And what's interesting is to see the people who are offering her things, they say, we have these cures, $10,000 a month, and you'll be cured. Now, when a person's scared for his life, so then a person is saying, you know what? How can I not spend this money? So I'll mortgage the house, but how can I not spend this money? It's my life. And
better.
That's what? What?
If they get better, they're in trouble.
If they get better, okay. The Torah is telling us a counter threat. Everyone around you is going to be threatening you. If you don't serve my idols, this will happen, this will happen. God says, you want to know the basic formula? You keep the Torah, things will go well. You don't keep the Torah, things will go bad. And those of you who are attending Friday's class on the Rambam, we're holding by the Rambam's analyzing, how does this work? Do things really work that way? You keep the Torah and things go well? So the Rambam raised that question, and in the Rambam class on Friday, we will, God willing, deal with that.
Are we learning
this coming Friday, God willing, yes. We might have a shorter class, but we will have class, hopefully. And by the way, if we're already off topic, then Thursday night, tomorrow night, we have a special class. I hope you have your questions prepared.
Yeah.
9 p.m. God willing. No, I'm sorry, 8:30 after supper. So 8:30, just like this class. We start 8:30 till when you guys have strength. God says, I'll pay back the individual. I can't pay back the individual. And if the tribe does this, if the people sin, so then the people will be exiled. And God says that everyone's going to wonder how's there such destruction in this land? How is it that the land of Israel is so destroyed? And if anyone read, we had posted on the bulletin board Jewish quotes about Jews. One of the quotes I think was Mark Twain about the Jews. And there's also a quote from Mark Twain about the land of Israel, how destroyed the land was when he came to visit the land of Israel. All the years till we got back here, it was destroyed. And what's the green line? That's the extent of where we planted. You could see that till there it was green. Beyond that, it's still destroyed. That's why it was called the green line, because that's till where we had at a certain point. So God says, you're only responsible for the things you see, you and your children forever. The things that are hidden, that's not your responsibility. Now, hidden doesn't only mean you can't see, but it also means you can't access. During the generations that our leaders were sinners, so there was nothing we could do. So that we're not held accountable for. But what we could help rectify, that we are held accountable for. And the Torah says this is forever, to keep the words of the Torah. And here we have the basic tenet of Jewish faith, that the Torah is eternal. The Torah says these mitzvahs are forever. They're not going to change. As the Rambam says, that is one of the 13 principles. Zot ha-Torah lo te'imchlefet. This is the Torah. It shall not change. God gave us this formula, and He gave the rabbis the guidance of how to guide us within the guidelines of the Torah. But the Torah is not going to change. God says when all this happens, the blessing and the curse, then you'll take it to heart and you'll repent. So if you recall, we learned in Shoftim about a Shofet named Yiftach. Jefti, right? Yiftach. So Yiftach, he was with his people and they banished him. They said, you're not going to inherit with your brethren, you're from a different wife. And the elders didn't back him, even though legally he had a right to inherit his father. And then when we were attacked, so the people came to Yiftach and they said, Yiftach, lead us to war. And Yiftach said, why are you coming to me now? Now that you need me, you come to me? I'm only coming back if you appoint me as your king, if I'm going to be the eternal leader of the Jewish people. Now, if you think about it, there's some logic to that. If you really wanted me, come back to me, not when you need me. And that's what our sages said. Try to do tshuva when you're young. My father always says that there are two types of people that he has a hard time evaluating their prayer when they pray fervently. One is a teenager when he's dating girls, so he thinks, I want this to be the one, so he could pray fervently. The question is, does it last? Another one is a pious person that you see when he reaches the age of 95, so he thinks he's on his deathbed already, so then he becomes very, very pious. The measure of a pious person is be pious throughout your life. Don't be pious in the beginning and in the end. You got to be pious throughout. Now, in truth, a person could do tshuva his last day, and it's worth it. It is worth something. Tshuva at any point is welcome. But a person is supposed to be pious throughout. And God over here is saying that he will not go the way of Yiftach. God is saying, even though you could say, well, we're only doing tshuva because it's bad. Things are bad, so we do tshuva. God says, I'll still accept you. You do tshuva, I'll take you back. You do tshuva even because it hurts, I'll take you back. God's always willing to take us back. Even though we could say, well, we're only doing tshuva because it hurts, God says, still, I'll take you back. Now, the Torah says, if you'll be scattered to the edge of land, just one more point. There's an interesting Medrash quoted by our Parsha. The Medrash says that over here the Torah discusses the roots that will flourish people who are bitter, like bitter herbs, and they're destructive to the Jewish people. The Medrash says there was supposed to be a generation with Taf Taf Kuf Ein Dalet. That's 974 wicked, wicked people. And the Medrash says that these people were going to bring destruction to the world. So God said, can't have that. We'll spread them out throughout the generations. And every time you have a wicked leader arise, you should know he was one of those. So the Medrash says, he's one of those roots that the Torah says over here. Maybe there's a root among you. The Torah is referring to those roots that God said, I'll scatter throughout the generations. God also said, I have so many tzaddikim, I have to spread them throughout the generations. There aren't that many. How many tzaddikim are there already? So God said every generation has to have its tzaddikim. And here that's where you have the famous Lamed Vav tzaddikim that people say there's no generation without 36 tzaddikim. That's this medrash that says God scattered them throughout the generations.
But they don't have to be Jewish, do they?
The tzaddikim of the Rishayim.
No, the Lamed Vav. Yeah.
I don't remember. I don't know.
Jews, they're like super, super pious, and I don't know if they know it themselves, but they're like, super, you know.
Yeah, but that's how many Jews?
How many bad people?
I don't know. It's a good question.
You can count the few,
I don't know how many bad people to ask. Who knows? Okay,
yeah. They're
hidden, right? There's a cool blog called Lamed Zion.
What?
There's a cool blog called Lamed Zion.
Okay. God says you'll do tshuva. The Jewish people will ultimately repent. And the Rambam says this is talking about the end of time. That there's going to be mass repentance. A lot of people are going to do tshuva. And that's why I hear people talking today. At a time like this, we're near the Gula, so we have to do tshuva. So tshuva is always a good thing. Today, tomorrow, yesterday. And if it spurs you on to think that it's because the redemption's on the way, so that's also a good thing to think. Our sages said, a person should think like maybe tomorrow he's going to die. Who knows? And, if we thought we would die tomorrow, what would we do? God says, you do tshuva, umal Hashem party also. The Torah says, that we skipped the point, but maybe we should have spent more time on it. Torah says that the person who sins is like a person who says, I want to quench my thirst. And it's interesting that when a person thinks back to his sins, usually he says, gee, that was fun. I want more of that. There's the famous story about the woman who used to come to the priest, and every Sunday she'd come and tell him about how bad she was as a child, all the different sins she did and the illicit relationships. And finally, after a few weeks that she comes, he tells her, "Lady, you're forgiven. You told me this last week and the week before and the week before. Why do you keep coming back?" And she said, yeah, but every time I tell it to you, I enjoy it again. That's the way we are. When we sit in coming towards Rosh Hashanah, thinking about what we did wrong, so sometimes that thought itself we could enjoy. Our sages say that the thought of a sin is sometimes more enjoyable than the sin itself. That's what pornography is all about. People's minds and their imaginations can enjoy more than anything else. The Rambam in the Laws of Tshuva enumerates the averos that it's difficult to do tshuva on. And one of them, he says, is looking improperly at women, because that's something that a person says, "What did I do wrong? I didn't touch her. I didn't do anything. What did I do? I just saw." The Rambam said that's why it's such a difficult sin to do tshuva from. The Rambam enumerates the sins that people have a very hard chance at ever succeeding in doing tshuva. And one of them, he says, is this. He says the reason is because this is something that a person feels, "What did I do wrong? What's there to show for it?" No one can tell when you do or don't look properly or improperly. So a person has to think about that, but not spend too much time thinking about it, because problem is they get sidetracked. So the Torah says in the man sfota avat atzmiah, the sinner says, "I want to quench my thirst. I'll go. I'm still thirsty." So our sages have an interesting mashal about that. They say it's like a person who's thirsty and he drinks salt water. He drinks salt water. He says, "I'm thirsty. I'll drink more. I'll drink more." The more you drink, the thirstier you get. It's not like you're going to quench the thirst. The same thing is true with the person's desires. A person will never die and have half of what he wanted in life. If you seek what you want, then you'll never get it. Sages said, "Lo me'ever layami." The Torah says in our parsha that if you want to attain Torah, it's not the other edge of the sea. You don't have to cross the sea. So our sages said this applies to a person who thinks, "I'll go across the sea, I'll make a lot of money, I'll be a big businessman, and I'll learn Torah." So Torah says it doesn't work the way. You want to get to Torah? Zot Torah. How do you attain Torah? Adam kemut bol. A person puts himself to death in the tent of Torah. If a person focuses on what am I going to eat lunch, and what am I going to have for supper, and what am I going to eat, and he allows his focus to be on the physical, so then he can't really connect to the spiritual. The more a person is attached to the physical, the harder time he's going to have to connect to the spiritual. So we're all connected to the physical, and we shouldn't trick ourselves, we shouldn't fool ourselves. We are connected. We're made of mud, and we are attracted to the physical, but we should try and limit it. People did once say, where does it say? "Eat and drink, for tomorrow you may die." It doesn't say eat, drink, and be merry. It says eat and drink. In the Navi. Which Navi? I don't remember if it's Yishai or Yirmiyah. I don't know if it's metaphorical. People say, things are going to be bad. So I just asked. If people thought tomorrow they were going to die, what would they do? So that the response was party. What? I don't know if they wouldn't even drink. Look at what people's last requests are.
People that have died, and the last thing they did was drink water. I don't be thirsty when I'm dying.
Look, I've seen people, I've been to eulogies where people were still getting their last revenge in. Dad left me as a will to curse out his brother. So I just did that. I was at a eulogy like that. The guy was on his deathbed, and that was what was important to him. To curse out his brother. So in front of everyone, he cursed out his brother. Yeah.
Just what I was saying, really quick, a Simpsons on Homer was like getting advice on how to live life. And it's like, live life as if you're going to die tomorrow. So he's sitting on the side, like, "I don't want to die."
Okay. My sixth grade Rebbe started class with a joke about two people who were working. They didn't understand too much. And one asked the other guy, "Why do we work so hard and the boss makes all the money?" So he says, "I don't know." So he says, "Why don't you go ask the boss?" So they go to the boss, and this one worker, Bill, he asked the boss, he says, "Joe and I were wondering, why is it that we do all the hard work and you make all the money?" So the boss says, "It's called intelligence." So Bill says, "Intello what?" He says, "Intelligence." He says, "Boss, what's that?" So he says, "Come, I'll explain to you." puts his hand in front of a trunk of a big fat tree and he says, Bill, do me a favor, punch my hand as hard as you can. Bill says, boss, I don't want to hurt you. I'm very strong. If I punch your hand, that's really going to hurt. So the boss says, no, don't worry, Bill. After this, you'll understand what intelligence is. So Bill says, okay, boss, if you say so. He winds up and whack, the boss pulls his hand out and he smacks it straight into the tree. His hand is gushing blood. He says, that's intelligence. Bill, anytime you have a question why I'm making the money and you're doing the work, remember, that's intelligence. Bill says, you know what, boss? Thanks. I'll think about that. Comes back to Joe. He says, Joe, I got it. I know why. Joe says, yeah, why? He says, it's called intelligence. He says, tell her what? He says, I'll explain it to you. Joe, look, I'm going to put my hand right here in front of my nose. You can... So with every message that we give here, you have a choice of taking the message and using it intelligently, or with intelligence, like putting your hand in front of the nose. So it's true, yeah. If a person realizes that tomorrow's his last day, he can sit on the sidewalk and cry and say, I don't want to die. That's true. God says, if you're going to be scattered to the edge of the heavens, still I'll gather you. I'll bring you back. And here we have a message, Kibbutz Galiyot. The concept that you hear mentioned all the time, that the Jews will be regathered, so God promises that in our parsha. And at the same point that God says there will be general tshuva, everyone's going to do tshuva, God says there will also be the bringing back of the Jewish people to the land of Israel. And that's why you have many people claiming the Falasha and all kinds of people saying, yeah, we're part of the Jews, we have to be back also. Either they are or they aren't. But at any rate, that's this prophecy that God says, I'll bring them back from wherever they are. And we have a tradition, God says the edge of the heavens, we have a tradition that the 10 tribes were exiled to the other side of a river called Sambation, Sambastion, which comes from the word really Sabbation, which is what it's called in earlier Midrashim, from the word Sabbat, which is Shabbat, and in Greek they always had the Yon. You'll see in the Gemara many times when it discusses Greek terms, Greek cures and stuff, it always has the end of Yon. So Sabbat is called Sabbation, Shabbos. And this is a river that shoots up rocks and on Shabbos it rests. And we have a tradition that the 10 tribes were banished by Sancheiriv when he destroyed them to the other side of that river, and they will be brought back when the Jews will be regathered. There are Midrashim that say that they were totally lost. There was a person that was found during the period of the Rishonim. His name was something Haddani. You remember something Haddani, who claimed he came from the tribe of Dan. He was a big Talmud Chacham. And the Rishonim accepted his story. They said that it could be he comes from the 10 lost tribes because he was a tremendous, tremendous sage. And he is quoted in very early sources. So our sages seem to have had this tradition, and this backed it up, that they were banished there. There's another medrash that says that they were scattered after they crossed the river Sambation and they intermarried and they no longer exist, that they're intermarried throughout the world. Okay, yeah. You want something? No? Okay.
I like the story you told on Shavuot. Oh. That one,
yeah? Yeah. So on Shavuot we discussed that, yeah.
That was the Mashiach. I don't know which rabbi said about the idea of completion, that the 12 tribes, like a healthy balance, like completion of the Jewish. So if these tribes are lost, and the time of the Mashiach, is it possible to have this healthy Jewish structure?
So that quote, that rabbi who said that, was going with the understanding that they're still around. There is also an understanding that says they were brought back, that they're among us. The Gemara brings two understandings on that. Do we have among us from the 10 tribes? It seems that we do. God says, you'll repent, Umal Hashem Elokecha, God will circumcise at Levavcha your heart, at Levav Zarecha, the heart of your offsprings. So here we have a few interesting messages. God says our hearts are problematic. Every person has to remove some stuff from his heart. It's a little bit, we're all a little bit hard-hearted. And God says he will help us with that. And from here we derive the principle, Habal Etel Meseinoto, if someone wants to become pure, God helps him. Our sages say that if God didn't help us, we could never overcome the Satan. We could never overcome him. There's the famous story of the Netziv. He was sitting and learning alone in the Beis Medrash, and the Mashgiach asked him, why are you learning alone? Where's your Chavrusa? She said, my Chavrusa is the Yetzer Hara. So he said, why are you learning with a guy like that? So he said, two reasons. One is he's much smarter than I am. And two, whenever I want to learn, he's always there. So that was the Netziv's answer. So God says, we have the Gemara says, that if God didn't help us against the Yetzer Hara, we could never win. And every day there's a baskol, there's a heavenly voice that comes out of the Beis HaMikdash, and with that heavenly voice comes special assistance to any person that wants to overcome the Yetzer Hara. And any person that wants, God says, I will help him. And God says, if you do your part, then I'll do my part. You do an opening like the opening of the eye of a needle, and I'll open it like the opening of the ulam, that was the tall gates in the Beis HaMikdash. God says, then I'll send these curses to your enemies, and you'll repent. Let's take one step back. God says, who will repent? You and your offsprings. So there's a nice Hasidish part on this. The Hasidim say, why does God say you and your offsprings? Because usually when a person does tshuva, so he becomes a big tzaddik. And his son rebels, he becomes a big rasha. And by the third generation, they know nothing. They're like tam. They're like innocent. They grew up by this father who was a rasha. And the next generation already knows nothing about Judaism. There ain't no Yedad Shoah. They don't even know the questions to ask. So they say, when we say on Pesach, the four sons, that's like four generations. You have a Chacham, you have the father who's a big rabbi. His son who's a Rasha, he rebels, he goes the other way. The grandson already is, he's a simple guy. He doesn't know. He doesn't know this way or that way. And the great-grandson, he's already knows nothing about Judaism. He could repent, he'll come back. Then we have the Chacham. His son hopefully will be the Chacham. And then the cycle continues. So God says, in the times of Mashiach, I'll help you guys out. Then it'll be levavcha, your heart, vet levav zarecha, and your offsprings, your children, they won't have to rebel and go the other way. You'll have one generation after another fulfilling God's way. And that's why our sages say that there's a special blessing if you have Torah and a family three generations straight. If you can maintain three generations in your family that keep Torah properly, so then you have a promise that it's going to be difficult to get out of it. The problem is that it's very hard to get three generations straight that fulfill Torah the way they should.
When you say fulfill Torah the way they should, I mean, to what extent?
I don't know.
With not a single person in those in that line that,
I don't know if it means that. Maybe it means father, grandson, great-grandson. Maybe the uncles don't affect it. I don't know. On the one hand, we say Torah mechazeret al be'aleah. The Torah likes its steady owners. On the other hand, we say that if a person's a rabbi, then there's a special omen from heaven that his children won't be rabbis. God says, I'll make it extra difficult for his children to be rabbis, so people shouldn't think you can't be a rabbi unless your father was a rabbi. So God says, I make it difficult for rabbis' kids to be rabbis. If someone's a Talmud Chacham, then his son is going to have 10 times as hard a struggle to become a Talmud Chacham. Because God says, I don't want the rabbi's kids to be rabbis. People shouldn't think you have to be a rabbi's son to be a rabbi. You want to learn? Torah's waiting for you. There is free choice. That's what God says.
Oh, there is,
that's in our parsha. We're about to get to it. What?
How literally can you take this? It's 10 times harder. How can you define
that? Doesn't mean you don't have free choice.
It must differ from situation to situation.
Differs, but to an extent, we know that things are difficult. I have free choice, but if a person was born to wicked parents and he grew up in a wicked home, then it's going to be more difficult for him to gain positive traits, even though he has free choice. So by the same token, God says, if he's a rabbi's son, he's going to have to work harder to get there. God says, I'm giving you the mitzvos. Listen to the mitzvos. Things will go well. And it's not so difficult. It's not obscure. The Torah isn't covered. The Torah is available. The Torah is waiting for whoever wants to come and get it. Lo nifleti mimcha, it's not covered from you. Here we see, any Jew who wants to learn Torah can learn Torah. And no one is able to say, I've done my part, I've tried. You tried? Try again. Try harder. Take the time to learn. Every person has to take time to learn. Even if a person learned everything, he has to take time to learn Torah. Well, a person's never finished learning. And the Torah is not distanced from us. The Torah deals with day-to-day things that we need. We might not always know how to derive the answer from the Torah, but the Torah has answers for all our questions. The Torah isn't in the heavens. Our sages say this means that if it were in the heavens, so you'd have to put rung on top of rung to get it. But it's not. It's easy. It's accessible. By the same token, our sages say it's not with people who keep their nose in the heavens, people who are haughty. You want to learn Torah, you have to be modest. The Torah, the Gemara says, is like water. Just like water tends to go from up to, it goes down. You put a container, you put a solid in a container, it maintains its form. You put a gas in the container, it takes the form of the container. Put a liquid in the container, then it all goes to the bottom, it takes the shape of the bottom of the container. That's why the Torah is called water. Torah is called Maim Chaim, live water, because the Torah is like water and that it always goes to the low point. God gave the Torah on Mount Sinai, which was the lowest mountain. God appeared the first time to Moshe Rabbeinu in the sneh, the low, low bush. God likes things that are low. God is up on top and He sees what's low. When we say Hallel HaGadol, the great Hallel, when we say something great about God, God says what's great about me is that I go with the low people. I go for the low, the guy on bottom. Mekimi me'afal dal, God picks up the poor from the bottom. God says whoever's hori, there isn't room enough in this world for me and him together. And that's why it's forbidden for a person to be hori. We wear the yarmulke. Yarmulke comes from the word yare me'eloka, fear of God. I know God is above my head. When a person walks around, he's supposed to know someone's watching him. Kippah is a covering. Kippah is like a dome.
What's the yarmulke?
Yare me'eloka. The Torah isn't across the river. You don't have to cross seas to get it. And this means not only is the Torah accessible, but also if you want to get Torah, you can't spend your life going on journeys. You can't be a businessman. If you're looking to make money, so you're going to make money. But the odds of learning Torah are very slim. It's possible, but it's very improbable. Our sages say, other than Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, they couldn't find the person who was wealthy, maintained his wealth, and maintained his Torah. Our sages say that's a very difficult thing to do. And that's Allah and Shulchan Aruch as well. Shulchan Aruch says, ideally a person should try to learn Torah and get a good parnasa. But most people who try that don't end up learning Torah the way they should. So if a person really wants to learn Torah, he has to forgo a lot of his parnasa. Because a lot of people say, I'll work and I'll learn. And most of the time, they don't end up learning the way they could and should. Now, learning Torah, I'll get to Ari in a second. People always think learning Torah means open the Gemara and break your head. And then when you get a headache, learn some more. And then when you feel like you can't do it anymore, that's when you have to force yourself, and that's learning Torah. It doesn't work that way. Our sages say learn Torah the way you like learning Torah. You have to learn a certain amount of Gemara. You should also learn a certain amount of Medrash. Read some stories from the Torah. Our sages said a person who has Gemara and doesn't have Medrash won't be a God-fearing person. Medrash is the source of gaining Yiras Shamayim. This is a Medrash Tanchuma. Just a second, I have to try and remember where it is. You could see it. It's quoted in the introduction to the Medrash Rabbah. But if I'm not mistaken,
Medrash Rabbah,
in the introduction, in the Shlaz introduction, and others, I should have it at home. Remind me, I should have it written down exactly where it is at home. Medrash is a source for Yiras Shamayim. Rav Zevin writes, he compiled a book of stories of Hasidim. He says, anyone who believes all the Hasidic stories is a fool. Anyone who doesn't listen to any of them, then Rav Zevin. I don't know if it's his saying. He's going to be an apikoros. It's known that you need the stories. You need the stories in the Torah and the stories of our tradition. And we don't always say that our sages meant it literally. When our sages discussed that they were traveling in a ship, and then they stepped out on an island, and as they were walking across this beautiful island, they discovered it was a huge fish. And then they rushed back to their ship, and the whole story is of Rabbi Bar Bachana that the Gemara quotes these fascinating stories. So we know that the Gemara doesn't mean literally that this is what happened, but nonetheless, there is an importance to reading the stories, and that's part of learning Torah. A person doesn't have to think that you have to learn all day. It means learn Gemara. Learn Gemara, learn Mishnah, learn Medrash, learn Tanakh. That's all Torah, and that's all important. And if a person says, I came home from work, I didn't have strength to learn Gemara, that's why I didn't learn. So the answer is, fine, you needed to rest, so why didn't you read some Medrash on the Parsha? There are beautiful stories on the Parsha. But I can't do all the Medrash, I want to finish something. So take a Medrash Tanchuma, that's an easy Medrash. Take the Medrash says in English. Take a Medrash of Psikta Drav Kahana, that's a small Medrash on the Haftaras of each Parsha. There are small Medrashim also. There's a lot out there. And if you can't find it yourself, so speak to Rabbi. But the Torah is accessible to everyone. You should know that the Midrashim started out as a way of passing over halacha to the people. They gave Midrashim, they used to incorporate stories into their speeches, because when people came to learn the Parsha, they came to the Rabbi's shir once a week on Shabbos, and these were people who didn't know Birchas Hamazon, and they knew almost nothing. The Rabbi had to teach them halachos. So in order to keep them interested, he'd incorporate with halachos stories. Now these stories have very, very deep meanings, and very deep messages. The secrets of the Torah are hidden in these stories. But they also have simple messages. And with these stories, they would incorporate a lot of halacha. And that's why I read Medrash Tanhuma. You'll see a lot of halacha in Medrash Tanhuma. You can't learn halacha from Medrash Tanhuma. We don't paskin like the Medrash Tanhuma and everything. But you will get a dab of many, many halachas by learning Medrash Tanhuma. And there are many sfarim that way, in Hebrew and in English. So the Torah says it's accessible to everyone. We know there are different crowns. And the crown of Torah, that has many, many, many things in order to attain the crown of Torah. The first Mishnah in the sixth chapter of Pirkei Avos enumerates all the things one has to do in order to acquire the crown of Torah. It's more than all the other crowns, but it's also not inherited. The best crown, the crown of Torah, is accessible to everyone. You want to learn Torah? Go learn. You want to find the Rebbe? Find the Rebbe. And it's close to you, it's in your heart, it's accessible to everyone. God says, I get back to you. Yeah.
You just mentioned that the crown of Torah is the highest and most important. Doesn't it say in Pirkei Avos that
Keter Shem Tov. I was waiting. Okay, second thing. When we learn Pirkei Avos, we'll have to get that. Look at that Mishnah. Okay, that's why I give the source for what I was saying. Look at the other Mishnah and then you'll understand what I meant. Look at the Mishnah, the first Mishnah in the sixth chapter of next.
Second question. You said before that the only person who was wealthy and learned Torah and all that condition?
No, it was a person who was tremendously successful. The Gemara says, "Lo matzanu Torah u'gdula b'makom echad, ela b'revi." It's a Gemara in Gittin Daf Nun Tes. I've written in front of me. I don't remember it. I wrote it down as I was preparing. So the Gemara says, the Gemara then asks, "What about so and so? What about so and so? What about so and so?" The Gemara in general. To have greatness, to be a great, great Torah scholar, and to be a tremendously wealthy person who maintains his wealth, you can inherit wealth. But to maintain wealth and take care of it, we have a lot of sages who inherited wealth. But to be a great sage who also cultivated his wealth and his learning, and was successful in both, that's Rebbe.
So isn't the condition, one of the conditions for being a judge, to have the knowledge
So that wealth, he might have gotten a stipend that gave it to him, and it could be he got it inherited, and it could be like the Rambam says, that when we say wealth, we mean Ezo Ashir Asamech B'Cherko. And it could be that that condition is not critical. You have to look over there. Let's leave that. Okay. You're quoting to me from the Torah, and you're quoting to me from what Yisro said to Moshe he should seek. Halachically, I don't think that's a condition. Yeah.
Yeah, just a question on the study of Gemara. The idea of Talmud Torah is not necessary. It's not an intellectual kind of stimulus, right? So many times, especially with Gemara, there is this danger that your goal there is just that intellectual kind of stimulus. So if you are doing it for that, are you fulfilling the
you're fulfilling not in the highest level, but as we discussed and we'll continue discussing in Friday's class, no one can begin by learning Lashem Shemaim, and everyone starts out with Lo Lashem Shemaim. Some people learn so that they could give a Dvar Torah at the Shabbos table. Some people learn so that they could enter shul and they won't look like fools. And some people learn so they could be a rabbi and people will give them honor. People have different reasons why they learn, and all of them are legitimate, and they are part of the process in getting to learning Torah L'Shem Shemaim. A person has to try and attain that level, but it's not easy. Okay, we will end with the Torah says we have free choice in our parasha. Choose the way of life, choose the way of the Torah, and then you will be successful in the land and live a life of longevity in the land of Israel. Notice the land of Israel. Notice that one of the tenets of Jewish faith is that we do have free choice. That doesn't mean we don't have a predisposition to certain sins. A person does have certain inclinations, but we still have free choice. Correct. That's the end of the parasha. And then you will be successful and live in the land of Israel a long life. And that brings us to the end of Nitzavim. We haven't yet started Vayelech. That will mention be tomorrow night. Gentlemen, tomorrow night we will hopefully have a class.